Biology. I'm Greg Muller, the instructor for this course. In today's lecture, Absorption of Toxicants, what we're going to do is try to talk about this progression of toxicology sources, pathways, receptors, and controls. I like to talk about this in terms of a sequence, and in fact, the absorption of toxicants is in that first stage where we have a source of a toxicant, and we actually have the initiation of a pathway. We cross that fundamental threshold from chemistry to biology. As we do this, Cross, we'll have to know about some of the structures, the routes, for example, of intoxication, and that's perhaps the major point of today's lecture. Our learning objectives, what we're going to do is try to describe some of the ways in which toxicants interact with cells. What are we but cells and collections of cells, which are in fact collections of chemicals and biochemicals? And so if we have a chemical, a toxicant, actually going to interact, how does this interact with these fundamental structures and substructures? We're going to recognize how the molecular characteristics of toxicant affect its entrance into a cell. We're going to try to explain some human anatomy. This is not an anatomy course, but I want to give you some briefing here in lecture and also in our textbooks of how toxicology is related to the integumentary, respiratory, and digestive systems, the three major modes of intoxication or pathways of intoxication. We're going to try to summarize these routes of toxicant absorption as well. Well, it's easy for us to kind of understand the organization of the body because in a certain sense, especially in the macro sense, it's a part of us. It's who we are. But what we'd like to do is look at it in terms of the different levels of organization of the body. And so in terms of toxicology, we are very interested in the chemical level because toxicants are just that. They're chemicals. And so they interact on a very direct basis with the chemicals and biochemicals that are in our life system. We then advance to the cellular system and then to the tissue level and the organ level and the organ system level, okay? Finally, that will maybe have a disease manifestation that affects the entire individual. But we start off small. We start off in terms of our interactions at the molecular level. And so we'd like to understand how this organism organizes from the molecular level on through up, because if we have an effect at the smallest level, that can affect the demonstration of organization up through the whole life cycle. It's important for us to understand metabolism, the biosynthesis as well as catabolism that's associated with the development of the molecules of life. It's important that we understand that these molecules of life start out as subunits and that are typically monomers and develop into polymers. So these subunits are the raw chemicals, and sometimes we can have some substitutions or some impacts where a toxicant actually impacts the subunit level. But then we have macromolecules, and some examples of those are saccharides to polysaccharides, glucose to glycogen, amino acids to proteins, and nucleotides to DNA and RNA. And so interrupting this assembly, the biosynthesis of these polymers, these macromolecules, is a potential source of toxicosis. We can look in terms of the relative importance of some of these monomers and the polymers if we examine the composition of bacteria. And this table gives us the makeup of E. coli in terms of some of these endpoints of biosynthesis. We all know that the percent of water is 70 or 80% in most light forms. It only accounts for one molecule. That's in contrast to proteins, which amount to about 10 to 15% in various life forms, that actually give us as much as 3,000 individual types of molecules. Great diversity in proteins. That should be a clue that, in fact, in terms of the mechanism of our body and all of the life systems that we support, proteins have a specific, because of their diversity, have very specific roles, and the potential to disrupt is very high because there's so many of them. In terms of the molecules of life, nucleic acids, DNA and RNA, we have one DNA, obviously, but in terms of RNA, RNA codes for specific proteins, and so we need at least as many RNAs as we have discrete proteins. And so we'll have more than 3,000 RNAs. Polysaccharides, in terms of percent of total weight, about 3%, and there's about five or so different types of molecules. Lipids, about 20 different types of molecules. Various building block molecules, sulfate, phosphates of those type, about 500. And then various ions, about 20 different molecules. And so all of these tell us that, in fact, in terms of the consequences of intoxication, impacting proteins, at least from a numerical point of view, we have a high probability of potentially disrupting life processes. To understand toxicology absorption, we need to have a basics in biology and cell structure, and I'll take you back to your freshman, sophomore biology classes, perhaps even high school biology, and reorient you that in terms of the basic processes, we have the cell nucleus, the cell membrane, very important in terms of transport of chemicals into a place within the cell that perhaps these chemicals could do some damage. We have the ribosomes that enact the protein RNA coding. We have the cytoplasm, the internal cellular fluids, the mitochondria, which develop the energy for cellular processes. But these are important things to know and understand. So a quick review of your biology is probably going to be helpful in terms of understanding toxicology. To refresh your memories as well about the basic reproductive functions of the cell, in DNA we have the, in the nucleus, we have DNA that is performing replication, and that replication is allowing transcription of RNA that actually leaves the nucleus and allows for a translocation process in the ribosomes to actually make these proteins, which are essential to many different biological processes. These proteins enter the cytoplasm and sometimes are released from the cell. Now, these proteins are typically synthesized through a process called translation. It actually, these perform building block, are actually built from the building blocks called amino acids. These proteins are long chains of amino acids. They are made up of peptide bonds and disulfide bonds. It's very important because anytime we have an accumulation of structures or a buildup of structure, a metabolism, if you will, we have a potential for toxic interaction. And so in the building up of proteins, whether it be by toxic peptides or by compounds that interfere with the disulfide bonds and the protein conformation, these are potential aspects of toxicosis on a molecular basis. If we look at the role of proteins, and we will here in a moment, we can see that we can have dramatic effects from miscoding of proteins. The primary structure of our proteins is referred to as sequence. Sometimes these proteins are modified by various groups, heme groups, sugar groups, phosphates, and they give us the diversity that is, in fact, proteins. In terms of amino acids from your biology, remember that these are small molecules. I've given you a couple of them here just to give you an idea of what cysteine, alanine, look like. They give us an idea of what the subunits of proteins look like. As we collect those together, they spontaneously form these peptide bonds and amino acid chains. This particular chain I developed with some molecular modeling software, which is just based in terms of thermodynamics. Pretty much I just added one amino acid after another in kind of a chaotic array. What you notice is that they form long chains and they also have a substructure. And this substructure is identifiable a little bit with a space-filling model of the protein as these amino acid chains develop. You start seeing what amounts to a helical coil. And that helical coil is a secondary structure in a protein. We'll also get some folding and some pleated sheets. We'll also get some random coiling going on. But this gives us the dimensionality of proteins that is very important in terms of their presentation of receptors and active sites for various things like enzyme function, receptor function. And it's very, very important that as we understand toxicology, we understand the chemical molecular basis of toxicology, and we try to at least imagine this in three dimensions, even though our textbooks, our slides, are two-dimensional. On the website, we have some links to some structural programs that allow you to go in with certain macromolecules and actually grab them and rotate them. I invite you, in terms of resources and some of the challenges with this particular module, to go in and play with that structural software that is available over the internet, to look at some of these databases of biological molecules to get a sense for this third dimension, depth, so to speak, so that you kind of understand how chemicals relate to biochemicals. If we go back to our hemoglobin protein structure, again, this is a two-dimensional representation, and you can see the alpha coils here in terms of the protein substructure. But you can see that within this hemoglobin protein structure, we have the heme groups, and here are the white dots in both of these cases, the oxygen that that the heme group is using as to transport. And so this is important in terms of understanding the roles and relationships of intoxicating chemicals to the biochemicals that make us up. Now, in terms of protein functions, we need to understand that there is a potential for disruption once we have absorption of a chemical in terms of the primary phase of toxicosis. Protein functions are wide-ranging. We're going to go through a list here just to give you an idea of the complexity of these 3,000 or so chemicals that make up life forms. Antibodies, these are proteins that recognize molecules of invading organism. They're very important in terms of immune function. Receptors are part of the cell membrane. They typically will recognize other proteins or chemicals and somehow through some chemotaxis inform the cell. It'll tell them that to start a cascade of effects. If we look at things like endocrine disruption in terms of that particular toxicological effect, there's a receptor disruption. We have proteins that function as enzymes that will assemble or digest other chemicals. We have neurotransmitters or hormones that trigger receptors. We have structural proteins that form channels and pores within cells and support tissues. In terms of cellular absorption, there are many different functions that happen in terms of a chemical crossing a cellular membrane. Typically, the ways that chemicals cross that membrane will result from diffusion. That requires a concentration gradient, that we have a high concentration on one side of the membrane and a low concentration on the other. Sometimes we'll have a facilitated diffusion where there will be some membrane surface carrier proteins that actually facilitate the transport of these chemicals across the membrane. These, for instance, an example of this is glucose transport. And then we have active transport where we actually use cellular energy via ATP to help actually transport or change chemicals. Some examples of these are endo or exocytosis or phagoepenocytosis, the swallowing up that cells do in terms of their particular metabolism. Now, one of the things we need to kind of have a good recognition of as we undertake an analysis of absorption of toxicants is the structure and form of the cell membrane. And this is fundamentally, as you recall from your biology, chemistry, and biochemistry classes, made up of a phospholipids and a bilayer that forms these micellar membranes. It's very important that we understand that these, in fact, are chemicals that can have chemical reactions, okay? Even though they are structural, they still can be interacted. And so, for example, when we talk about oxidative stress and free radical damage, this lipid bilayer can be attacked, can have an oxidative attack by some free radicals, which cause a defect in the layer and perhaps rupture of the cell membrane, and again can potentially release those somewhat destructive contents or disrupt critical resources within that cell that are required for life. Now, we need to understand that for absorption that there are four basic types of cells in the human body. The epithelial cells, and they particularly make up things like covers and linings and secretions. Very, very important barrier, first layer barrier. There are connective cells. They give us support and energy. There are muscle cells. They allow us to move. And then the nervous cells. The nerve cells will yield electrical impulses, transmit information, the conduits, so to speak, of our neurological system. The two types that are most important in toxicology are the epithelia and the nervous system cells. In the epithelial, we have a classification, if we break down on this graphic, of what these cells look like in terms of their structures. Squamous shells are cells are flat. Simple squamous tend to actually run in rows, and stratified squamous tend to run in sheets. We'll have cuboidal and simple cuboidal and columnar type cell shapes in the epithelial. And these are specific for different types of tissue throughout the body. They help us manage particular processes that occur in that organ or organ system. In terms of nerve cells, you'll find that they're made up primarily of neurons of various kinds that allow for the development of a neurological response. They connect to each other via dendrites, and these dendrites have a synaptic cleft across which each cell can communicate to one another. And typically in neurotoxicity, we impact either the delicate balance of chemicals that allows the development of charge or polarization of the cell, or within an individual cell, or we disrupt some of the tissues that make up the cell and the cell membrane, or we upset the balance of the enzymes and the critical neurotransmitters that allow the cells, the neurons, to communicate with each other. And we'll talk about neurotoxicology in one of our lectures. In terms of the human body, we have 11 organ systems, the integumentary, or the skin, the largest organ in our body, the skeletal, the muscular, the nervous system, the endocrine system, the cardiovascular system, the lymphatic system, the digestive system, respiratory, urinary, and reproductive systems. Each one of these can be the target of intoxication. In terms of adsorption, this is the process by which toxicants cross this epithelial cell barrier. And so this is the critical first transmembrane movement in terms of the cascade of effects of toxicosis. And so what affects absorption will affect toxicosis. We talked about and introduced the concept in terms of the initial concepts in toxicology lecture about all the different chemical manifestations of toxicants and how those manifestations, physical state, like a gas or a liquid, its polarity, its pKa in terms of its ionization, its KOW, its octanol water partition coefficient, all of these chemical phenomena can affect absorption, and absorption therefore affects the exposure. The exposure will affect dose. Dose will affect the size of the toxic response. And so now you have the connectivity between the chemical and the disease manifestation. The routes of absorption are primarily integumentary or percutaneous, dermal, if you will, respiratory, and digestive. These are the three routes of absorption that we are primarily concerned with in toxicology. And so we have to have a good understanding of the physical structures and also the cellular makeup of those physical structures in terms of understanding routes of absorption. The integumentary system route is our skin, our hair, nails, mammary glands. It's the largest organ in the body, as I said. It's made up of the epidermis, the dermis, and the hypodermis. The epidermis is avascular. It's the outer one. It means it doesn't have a blood supply. It's made up of the keratinized stratum corneum, that's about 15 or 20 cells thick. It actually provides maximum toxicant protection. If you work around chemicals, it's a good idea to keep the skin, especially of your hands, in good shape. Cracks in your epidermis, cracked skin will allow more potential absorption via more potential exposure. The next layer down is the dermis. This is highly vascularized. This is where we have our nerve endings, so we have a lot of them in our hands, but in our skin in general, it's the touch that we have. The hair follicles, the sweat glands are in the dermis. In the hypodermis, we have the connective and the adipose tissue, the support tissue that gives us our good looks. Now, this gives you a kind of a graphical representation of what skin looks like in two-dimensional. Here we have the stratum corneum, the dead cells, if you will, that are out there, and we shed these on a regular basis. That's a part of the epidermis, followed by the dermis, this vascularized area, and then the subcutaneous hypodermis tissue that actually has a lot of the support structures and major blood flow capillary systems that provide the nutrients for cell replication and skin growth, but also provide a mechanism for transport of toxicants away from this barrier and into other areas of the body in a systemic intoxication. This gives you an idea of a quick case study in terms of skin lesion and how chemicals can have dermotoxicity of some variety or another. This is an unfortunate Kenyan child that found a pretty beetle. Unfortunately, this very attractive beetle was of the genus Brachianus, that is the bombardier beetles. Bombardier beetles have defensive mechanism that they have the mixing chambers in their body. They actually are very good at chemical warfare in terms of predator relationships. These two mixing chambers they have, if they feel threatened, they actually squirt out this particular toxin. It's a very high temperature exothermic reaction, so it's a hot fluid. It's a quinone-based toxin, and you can see from this young child, it's not a nice wound to have. And so this is a shooting insect venom. One of the major routes in terms of rapid intoxication is the respiratory system route. It's rapid because we've got that system of air. We breathe fairly rapidly, and we have extremely high the efficient exchange of atmospheric chemicals, primarily oxygen and CO2, across our respiratory membranes. It's made up of stratified squamous epithelial tissues on the skin, but in the respiratory system, it's a squamous epithelium with ciliated columnar and cuboidal epithelium. This allows for the development of non-keratinized, very soft tissues, but it's ciliated, and it gives us what's referred to as a mucociliary escalator. If you've ever been in a dusty environment for an extended period of time and find yourself coughing for the rest of the day, and you're coughing up what looks like dusty material, your sputum is dark. It actually is the inhaled dust that has risen up with these cilia, the little microscopic hairs, that is cleared over a period of time. And we've all have experienced that at one point in time. The respiratory system is made up of the nasopharyngeal, essentially the first part, then the tracheobronchial, and then finally the pulmonary system in terms of its relationship with exchange with your vascular system. This is a diagram, a cartoon of the respiratory tract. Here you can see the nasopharyngeal aspect of the system, the tracheobronchials, essentially hardware, its pipes going down into the pulmonary region. We have these going off into the primary bronchus, the distribution tubes into the from the major freeways into the minor back roads, the bronchioles. The bronchioles will feed the alveoli, high surface area tissues that allow for this membrane transport. The membrane transport is actually through the arterioles and the capillary function in terms of exchange, gaseous exchange, back and forth in terms of carbon dioxide and oxygen from respiration. You can respect that there are many other chemicals that have high enough vapor pressure, whether it is on inhalation or exhalation, that are high enough vapor pressure to cross those membrane thresholds as well. You can respect that the respiratory tract is in fact one of the routes of elimination, potential elimination of toxicants that have sufficiently high vapor pressure. In terms of the respiratory system route and the nasopharyngeal, it's our nostrils, our nasopharynx, our oropharynx, and laryngopharynx. There's hair and mucus in there that allow for trapping of greater than 5 micron particulates. It's really important in terms of risk assessment that we protect ourselves from particulates that are smaller than that, because there is not a good mechanism to remove those. They actually get trapped down in the tracheobronchial area, the trachea, the bronchi, the bronchioles, and the cilial action down there. The luminal mucus can trap those 2 to 5 micron particulates and water-soluble aerosols and gases, and so that particularly can have an effect, because it doesn't necessarily reverse, it doesn't climb that mucociliary escalator. And in fact, some of those small micron-sized particles are actually the ones that can do a tremendous amount of damage in terms of the manifestation of diseases such as silicosis and asbestosis. These are small, solid particles that will get trapped in silicosis because of size, in asbestosis because of the conformation of the particle. Asbestos is a needle-like particle. It's very hard for needles to actually be resolved via the mucociliary escalator. And so there's a tissue damage phenomenon in terms of asbestos exposure. In the pulmonary exchange area, we have the alveoli. These are extremely high surface area, maximized for gas exchange with the cardiovascular system. In terms of the membrane, if we were to actually take this extraordinarily high surface area lung tissue in an adult human and lay it out flat in terms of its surface area, it would cover, in terms of the estimated size, about half the size of a volleyball court. And so this is a very large-scale surface to allow membrane transport of volatiles. Because of the rapid influx of respiratory chemicals, it is a potential rapid route of intoxication, because it is highly managed in terms of allowing for membrane transport. This gives you an idea from a dissection point of view of what lung tissue looks like. This is a dissection I did on a bovine lung lobe. The idea was to just dissect this laterally in terms of the feel of this particular tissue, the bronchus bronchioles. This is a very cartilage type material, very hard structural material. Piping is probably the best way to describe it. It takes a lot of heft on a pair of sharp scissors to actually cut through this material. Whereas the pulmonary regions of the lung where gas exchange happens is a very soft and almost gelatinous type material. And so you get the structure in terms of this sort of material, and then the softer parts in terms of the other parts of the lung material. This gives you an idea in terms of the substructure on a close-up here, where we've got the bronchus leading off to the bronchi and the bronchioles through these little portals here in terms of the substructure that allow for transport of gases and exchange of gases throughout the whole mass of the lung tissue. And so that gives you an idea that it's a very efficient gas transport system, high surface area, high connectivity with all the area, the ability for us to sustain toxic damage if we are exposed to a significant toxicant is pretty significant. myself and my own experience as a scientist during my PhD studies. I was exposed to fluorine gas by another student that left a gas tank open. The only reason I knew that I was being exposed is I started tasting the metal fillings in my mouth. What in fact was happening, little to my knowledge at that point in time, was that the fluorine gas, F2, was actually reacting with the water in my lung tissue, creating hydrofluoric acid. And had I not gotten out of there because I started feeling quite ill, quite sick, that I would have sustained a significant amount of tissue damage and lung damage. It was met with a full hazmat team, and it gives you the idea that when you were working around chemicals, you should be very cautious and careful. Perhaps in recent history, one of the largest impacts of respiratory toxicology happened in Bhopal, India, where as many as 10 and some estimates 20,000 people suffered in a respiratory illness from a plasticizer chemical put out from a Union Carbide plant. It was a result of human error at the plant, at the factory. A couple of valves weren't set the way they should be, and a huge amount of mortality and morbidity in that particular case, and I believe that was 1984. Another case study more recently, and this happened in May 2000, was a fixed obstructive lung disease in workers at a microwave popcorn factory. You may have read about this or heard about this in the news. These reports come to us not only through the news, but this is the CDC publication Mortality and Morbidity Weekly that reports on clinical manifestations of disease, and quite often that's toxicosis. And so what this is I've given a few case studies here this semester that are reports out of the CDC Mortality Morbidity Weekly. In this particular case study, this is in Missouri at a microwave popcorn factory. For those of you with a background in food science, know about food additives and food flavors. In fact, in microwave popcorn, they try to give it the butter flavor. As it turns out, in this time period, there was a occupational medical medicine physician that actually made a report to the CDC to about 8 cases of fixed obstructive lung disease. Essentially, these individuals had exceptional levels of scarring on their lung tissue, and 4 of these particular workers were actually on a lung transplant list. They did some background investigation and found that these individuals had all worked at this one factory between the years of 1992 and 2000. This initiated an occupational health investigation, what was causing the potential disease and how much disease was being caused among the workers. And when they did their epidemiological assessments, they found that the workers in that particular factory were about 10 or 11 times more likely to have lung disease than the standard population. This is an indicator of a problem. In terms of analysis of the problem and follow-up, they assume because it was respiratory that it was associated either with chemicals or particulates that were in the plant of the atmosphere of the plant. They reduced it down in terms of the 100 or so volatile organic compounds that were in the plant air to compounds such as diacetyl, which is a compound, a flavoring that is used to flavor the butter, to give it a butter flavor in the microwave popcorn. This is a ketone. They found the mean air concentration about 18 part per million where it was actively being used, and then lesser concentrations throughout the plant. As it turns out, there is no PEL or permitted exposure level for this particular chemical compound. The suggestion was, although there was not a dose response, that these chemical compounds in the flavoring were causing this very high level of scarring in this. And in fact, the change in terms of plant operations included enhanced protection of workers from volatile species, and that was done by personal respirators and also by increasing air exchange throughout the plant and air exchange over those particular processes. If we transition now to the digestive system route in food toxicology, this is obviously one of the most important routes if we talk about the interaction of food and potential for toxicosis. This route involves the mouth, the oral cavity, the esophagus, the stomach, small intestine, the rectum, and the anus. As it turns out, the residence time can determine the site of toxicant injury. For the mouth, we have a relatively short amount of time. Small intestine, it's a relatively long amount of time. And so if this is a material that is going to have require a fair amount of time to have a toxic interaction, it may impact intestinal linings and not necessarily what occurs in your mouth in terms of a incidental injury. The absorption of toxicants can take place anywhere, but much of the whole structure in the digestion system is actually designed for absorption of nutrients and all of those molecules that are required for metabolism of those molecules of life. And so that happens in the gut. And so this is a system that has highly facilitated transport for some chemicals, opportunities for recirculation in terms of enterohepatic recirculation. So this is a system that's set up for absorption and therefore has a potential in terms of intoxication. There was a clinical case report a couple of years ago about an individual that was depressed, had suicidal inclinations, went out and drank a bottle of liquor and chased it with essentially what amounted to kitchen cleaner that was a lye-based material, strong base, potassium hydroxide. Potassium hydroxide actually will break down cell membranes very rapidly. If you've ever had base on your hand in the laboratory, you notice the slippery feeling. It kind of feels like soap because, in fact, it's making soap out of the fats that are in your skin membranes. So it's dissolving your skin. So this caustic actually had a dramatic impact on this poor individual. He actually was rescued after he attempted suicide. Unfortunately, it was a little bit too late in terms of some of the tissues, especially the esophageal lining and his stomach. And at that time, in terms of bringing this unfortunate fellow around to recovery, about all they could do was to remove his esophagus, remove his stomach, and actually take the undamaged part of the small intestine and actually connect it externally to his rib cage underneath the skin. And so he eats in small amounts and actually has to work this particular part of his body to affect absorption of the nutrients required for life. A fairly dramatic demonstration of intoxication with a caustic material. The gastrointestinal tract, as we know and understand in terms of introductory anatomy, we've got the mouth and the esophagus, essentially some piping to allow us to connect to the stomach where we first have the primary digestion systems. Though digestive systems are involved with liver and liver enzymes, enterohepatic recirculation via the gallbladder and discharge, and we'll learn more about that. But then we enter the intestinal tract, the large intestine, and the small intestine, finally through fecal elimination through the rectum. The digestive system route, in terms of differentiation of tissues, we have the mucosa. The mucosa is the outer lining. This is avascular. It's typically squamous cell or columnar cell epithelium. In some cases, the structures are villi and microvilli. The microvilli and villi actually aid in absorption. They're high surface area substructures. We'll see that in a micrograph here in a moment. We also have a submucosa, the layer below that mucous membrane in the digestive system. And that's where a lot of the exchange starts happening. We have high blood flow. We have lymph system interface there. Outside of that, we have the muscularis, which allows for that peristaltic movement that allows for the passage of food materials through the digestive system. Outside of that, we have the casing, the serosa, that contains all of this organ substructure in the gastrointestinal tract. In terms of the intestine and its structures and substructures, you see from this cartoon here, the small intestine. It is made up of some substructures where we have the villi and the mucosa on the surface and the submucosa. The villi themselves, these high surface area structures, are highly vascularized, again, optimized for nutrient absorption. They are vascularized not only with the blood system, but also with the lymph system, because we have a tremendous amount of immune function that's happening in terms of responding from an immune point of view to pathogens that might be in the food system. So the immune system there has to be very good at recognizing chemicals, toxicants, even potential allergens or pathogens, good ones from bad ones. Obviously, we want to absorb nutrients, we want to absorb proteins, we want to be able to absorb all of those molecules required for metabolic resources. So this is a particularly well-orchestrated symphony of absorption, if you will. The small intestine mucosa, actually this is a microscopic histology slide. Since I think this is my first introduction for you on histology, these are two-dimensional representations of three-dimensional cells or organs. And so I always tell students, next time you're cutting up a cucumber, try some experiments on cutting it in different directions and seeing what it looks like. If you cut it long ways, it has a dramatically different representation than if you cut it in small thin chips crosswise, which will give a round representation. So this is the lengthwise representation of these villi, and it gives you some indication of the cellular structure on the periphery that aids in membrane transport and absorption of nutrients as well as toxicants. Well, let's finish up today with a case study. In this particular case study, this is an herbal supplement. This is a case study associated with Jinbuwan toxicity in children. This is an incident report in Colorado, 1993. These three incidents I'm going to report came from Mortality Morbidity Weekly. These are unrelated instances in terms of they all had different aspects, but they all were similar in that they contain young children. They dealt with the young children and exposure to this particular Chinese herb. Now, traditional Chinese herbal products are widely available in the United States. It's a greater than $1 billion market. Because these are marketed as herbs and not as drugs, they do not have FDA oversight. There is some concern because people actually do take these as drugs or for a therapeutic value. They have sometimes very highly potent natural products. In this case, many times they're alkaloids. Jinbuwan is manufactured in China, and the stated ingredients are polyglycinesis, L-alkaloid at 30% and starch at 70%. It's an analgesic. It's used as a pain reliever. It has a known kind of morphine-type responses. It as well as a known hepatotoxin. People have taken this product on a regular basis and come down with acute and chronic hepatitis. And so this is something that should be well out of the hands of children. One of the problems associated with these types of products is the variability in terms of what's in it, not in terms of just the active ingredient that it's labeled for, but other plant or herbs that might be co-administered beyond what's on the label. In this particular case representation, patient one, this is a 13-month-old boy that actually was lethargic and breathing abnormally. When found about 20 minutes after ingesting about 60 of these tablets, this particular child presented with CNS, central nervous system depression, and was responsive only to painful stimuli. In other words, didn't really have the normal responses that we should have in terms of stimuli. He was lethargic, he had very relaxed muscles, no muscle tone, and he had transient bradycardia, rapid heartbeat. He actually was treated with activated charcoal. He was intubated and actually survived the episode and had no real follow-up problems in terms of the short term. In this particular case, patient number two, a 2.5-year-old girl, was lethargic and breathing abnormally. She was found about an hour after ingesting about 17 of those tablets. She was unresponsive in respiratory depression. Rapid heartbeat was treated with atropine. She had CNS depression symptoms, diminished respiratory weight, which she required intubation. Her condition improved, and she actually vomited out the tube that was actually placed to help her in her respiration. She had gastric lavage, also known as getting your stomach pumped to recover the tablets that were in there, about 8 hours. Urine and serum were negative for other typical compounds associated with drug intoxication. No permanent conditions in terms of the short-term follow-up of this patient. The third patient in this particular case study, a 23-month-old girl, was lethargic. Parents found her about an hour after she had about 7 of these tablets. She was transported to the emergency room. She had her stomach pumped as well. They administered charcoal and a cathartic to kind of make her vomit out as much of this material as she could. She was observed and then discharged, and again, no permanent impact to that. In terms of the case follow-up, this is as important to not only to track the individuals associated with these cases, but also the toxic agent. In this particular series of cases, an analysis of the product identified that it was 36% concentrated by weight levotetrahydropalmitine, LTHP, which is the active alkaloid not in the species identified in this particular bottle of herbs by another plant species. It has morphine-like properties. Each tablet contained about 28 milligrams of this particular material. But no other alkaloid was identified or from these particular plants. So what that does is give you some background as we tie up the end of our absorption lecture. It gives you some background on absorption of chemicals as we start this progression of events from sources, pathways, receptors, and as well controls within the body that allow us to get kind of a full-scale representation of toxicology. The next time, next lecture, what we'll do is we'll try to discover what happens next in terms of routes of toxicology. Once it's crossed those membranes, it is going to be transported and distributed throughout the organism and perhaps stored or metabolized. Until next time, we'll see you then, and thank you very much. Bye.